Session number 22917, A Century of Killing, Fergal Keane.
October Films interview with Fergal Keane on Wednesday, the 12th of December, for Century of Killing, the Imperial War Museum Genocides Exhibition. I'll start with just some very general big questions. The 20th century was an extremely violent one, and huge numbers were killed as a direct consequence of conventional warfare. But it also saw horrific mass killings of civilians, civilian populations by states on a massive scale right up to the present day. Can you give any reasons for this in the 20th century?
I think a number of things happened in the 20th century. The means of mass murder became much more efficient. It was possible to develop technologies which would dispose of huge numbers of human beings swiftly. I think the other critical point to remember is that it was the century of mass propaganda. It was the century in which radio, and in the later part of the century, television, enabled some political leaders to mesmerize populations with relentless demonization. If you look at what happened in Nazi Germany, and take a straight line through to Rwanda, where radio was again used as a means of convincing people that if they simply went out and dealt with the problem of the minority. In Nazi Germany it was the Jews, in Rwanda it was the Tutsis. If they simply did that, then their problems would be over. And to be able to reach into every home in the country, as was the case in Rwanda, to be able to reach into every peasant village with that kind of message of hate on an hourly basis, that gave governments a powerful weapon in being able to create a mass consciousness in support of genocide.
Important that genocide is recognised as an international crime, something that affects all of humanity?
When I came back from Rwanda, was puzzled by something, and that was, having seen war and killing in many parts of Africa and other parts of the world, why did this have such a huge impact on me? Now, there's a very clear physical reason. There were more people killed there than I'd ever seen before. But I think there was something. When one looked at the scale of the killing and the fact that it was civilians, entirely civilians, it was women and children, I looked at that and I saw in it the germ of all our destruction. That if you could take the idea that it was plausible to eliminate one population group, then suddenly it becomes possible to kill us all. Now that may sound a rather complex way of explaining what is a simple truth. But that if you do make it okay, or you don't impose the greatest possible international sanction on the idea of slaughtering an ethnic group, then it becomes possible to do it to everybody. And if you look at what happened since the Second World War, it took us until Yugoslavia, it took us until Rwanda, before we were willing to institute prosecutions under the law that we had. You know, the Genocide Convention isn't a new law. The war on the law on crimes against humanity, they're not new laws. They were framed after Nuremberg, yet it took us until Rwanda and Yugoslavia to put them into action. And in that time, there were numerous occasions when acts of genocide were carried out, but there wasn't the political will or the international community of conscience to support prosecutions. At last we have that.
What kinds of states and societies are generally most likely to commit genocide?
Here is one thing you must never forget. We can all do it. The idea that the Germans were naturally predisposed more than any other race to committing genocide, the idea that the Cambodians had some secret germ inside them, or that the Rwandese did, is absolute nonsense. We are all capable of it. The men that I saw carrying out genocide in Rwanda were people like me. You know, they weren't just hillbillies or men from the mountains. They were educated people. They were people who'd been to universities in America and Europe. They were part of the genocidal killing machine. It's about part of what humanity is, this capacity to believe that if we just wipe out the other tribe, our problems will be finished. If we just get rid of that troublesome minority, then we can live in a world without enemies. We're all capable of believing that. It took particular circumstances in Germany, in Cambodia, in Rwanda, to create the impulse or the occasion when genocide could be carried out. But as for the sort of part of human nature, I think we all have it.
What kinds of circumstances sort of trigger these kind of events off?
I think you need a number of. I think you need a number of circumstances. Economic depression. A situation in which people are poor and getting poorer and are looking for a scapegoat, somebody to blame. That certainly happened in Rwanda. It is a fact that the coffee price in Rwanda collapsed in the years leading up to the genocide, and that had a singular influence on a population which was already desperately poor. And when the political machine came along and said, well, look, you're poor. You're poor because these Tutsis are the ones who are taking all the money, making all the money. They're the ones who are exploiting you. Get rid of them and the problem will be gone. Add to that a certain degree of political insecurity and instability. Rwanda, at the time the genocide erupted, had gone through several years of civil war, so the population was already frightened. It was capable of being convinced that it had to act swiftly to get rid of this security threat. Those two things taken together. And I think education, I think the power of myth. It's frequently said of societies like Yugoslavia, like Ireland, like Rwanda, they're too obsessed with their history. That's wrong. We're not obsessed with history, we're obsessed with mythologies. The critical business is creating an institutional body of memory, of real history, of what actually happened. Not what people's granny told them happened, you know. Not a kind of biased mythology, but the facts, just give them the facts. And I think in all of the countries I've mentioned, and particularly in Rwanda, there was no history. People were not taught history, they were taught the politics of hatred.
So what is it you think these states want to achieve by committing genocide? What is this vision of a new society that they have by getting rid of a group of people who may not actually be a threat, but are actually made into a threat?
I think what you have in societies which resort to genocide are two different kinds of mind at the top. One is the, though it may sound perverse to say it, the idealistic mind, which believes in a utopia. This notion that if you just get rid of the enemy, you can have a perfect world. And we've seen examples of that. It doesn't always result in genocide, but for example, if you look at fundamentalism, at the core of that is the idea of a perfect world in which there will be no enemies, in which everybody will be like us, or else they'll be dead. You then have, along with that, what I call the cynical mind, and they are people who don't really believe that, who don't have any ideology of any kind, but who like power, who are addicted to power, and they go along with the ideologue. If you once saw that happening in Nazi Germany, with many of the people who clustered around Hitler. They weren't true believers in the sense of believing in his philosophy, but they certainly knew a good thing when they saw it in terms of power, in terms of privilege, in terms of influence. That happened in Rwanda as well. There was a core group of people who did have a Hutu power, what was called the Hutu power ideology, which proposed that Rwanda's problems could be solved by getting rid of the Tutsis. The cynics who went along with that were many people in the army, many people in the political establishment, many people in the business establishment, who saw good things for them by following this through. So it's a combination of two particular strands.
You've already talked a little bit about how the use of modern media and radio can be used to sort of make the rest of the population acquiesce in what is going on. But I wonder if you could expand on that a little bit more.
There's one thing I forgot to mention earlier when you talked about what it needs in societies. Yeah. The other critical thing, of course, which is needed in a society is an atmosphere of terror, of fear. And you, to obtain that, need to live in a dictatorship. Rwanda, prior to the genocide, was a dictatorship. It was one-party rule and had been since the foundation of the state. Nazi Germany was precisely the same. I don't believe that you can create the circumstances for a genocide in democracy, where there is a capacity for people to speak out, where you do have civil society. And the importance of civil society, you can see in many countries throughout Africa, which could have had genocides, but were able to resist those kind of atavistic urges because there was a a collection of organizations, of non-governmental groups, who brought people of different tribal groups and different races together, and were able to act as a powerful bulwark against the idea that you can solve your problems by killing the minority. Sorry. That was just the other critical point. Yeah.
Well, there seems to be a pattern in many kinds of killing experience where a group is marked out in some way and then sort of isolated from the main body of society and demonized to an extent where it becomes acceptable to remove them. And it's often made possible, as you said, by sort of prevailing conditions of war or conflict and in certain, usually within a dictatorship. But I wondered if you could just sort of perhaps describe that kind of process to us a little bit, because it seems to be able to happen extraordinarily fast sometimes. Everything unravels very quickly, or seems to unravel.
When people speak of Rwanda and say it was such a quiet country beforehand, I never would have imagined a genocide happening there, they are speaking a literal truth, that it was a place which had the best roads in Africa, where the people seemed to be quite calm when you visited. But of course, to say that is to miss the true dangers which surround genocide, and that is places that look terribly orderly on the outside and which seem to be going along all right. And remember, many people in Europe believed that of Hitler's Germany for quite a long time. What happens is a very subtle process in the beginning of demonization through the media. It gradually becomes much less subtle, so that, for example, on Radio Mille Collines, the extremist radio in Rwanda, what began as a campaign of abuse, for want of a better word, against Tutsis and describing them as people who were sponging, who were cockroaches, to use the famous phrase, by the time the genocide erupted, it became a radio station which was calling out lists of people's names to be murdered. So there was a gradual process where the limits of the acceptable, of what it was possible to do to people, were gradually expanded. And in the initial stages, it was acceptable to simply abuse people, to call them names, to denounce them. And by the 6th of April 1994, when Radio Mille Collines was announcing the places in Kigali where Tutsis might be found, it had become acceptable to slaughter.
It seemed to be a very different situation in Bosnia, where people actually were denied information. There was a sort of a lack, almost like, well, not a lack of propaganda, but a lack of real information. And in some respects, it seemed to have a similar effect. I wonder if you could talk about that a little.
I think in Bosnia the situation was slightly different in that, yes, there was a public media which played a part in the genocide. The real damage had been done by the handing down of myths through the generation. And not just myths, one has to say, there were brutal things which happened in Bosnia during the Second World War. But the way in which that history was told down the generations was profoundly damaging. Because again, it was about seeing the past solely in terms of the wrong done by the other side. And that was when it came to a situation where nationalist politicians wished to whip up hatred, there was already a decades-old bed of resentment and bitterness which they were able to tap into. And that was probably more powerful than the immediate role of the state media or of the nationalist regime's media.
And do you think all of that is sufficient to explain why people who live next door to each other as friends and neighbours for many, many years are able, in a very short space of time, to actually turn around and kill each other? This is a question that people often ask, how is this possible? Maybe there isn't an answer, but I'd be interested to know what you think of that.
I've asked myself that question many times. I've asked it in Ireland, in my own country. You know, when I was a young reporter in Belfast, and saw this happening. I certainly asked it in Rwanda and in Bosnia after the war. I think it comes about because people feel threatened. It's fundamentally about fear. Killing your neighbour is fundamentally because you're afraid. And there is a dreadful part of human nature which is violent, greedy, and which, when it's let loose, is a fearful thing to behold. And it is in all of us. It is in all of us. We're not all subject to the kind of atavistic hatred which governs a place like Bosnia or Rwanda. But we are all capable of killing. And I sometimes wonder what would happen to any of us, any of the people from the sort of Western liberal democracies, who sit back and go tut-tut at the behaviour of these savages in places like Bosnia and Rwanda, savages as they see it. How would we fare when confronted with similar pressures? The question everybody must ask themselves. Not just what would I do, because maybe most of us wouldn't carry out the killing of our neighbour, but what would we do if we saw our neighbour being killed? What action would we take? And remember that a great many people in situations like this are paralysed by fear. I myself in Rwanda saw people being rounded up and taken away, and I was sure that they were going to be killed. Did I run in to stop it happening? No, I didn't, because I felt terrified for my own life. And never underestimate the power of fear. That when you get a situation where law, where the moral order is turned upside down, and that's what happens in genocide, the moral order is turned completely upside down. When it is good to kill, and when it is bad to stop killing or to speak against it, ask yourself how you would behave when everybody else around you has become mad.
Our own understanding of these kind of events is shaped largely by journalists and but to what extent do you think that the journalistic process actually disguises the complexity of these situations and actually sometimes makes it more difficult to understand?
I think that journalism suffers from the immediate problem of being under pressure. You work to a deadline. You're not a historian, you're not a sociologist, you're not a philosopher. And yet in some respects you're expected to be all of these things when you're reporting back. I think journalism failed Rwanda hugely, because in the initial stages it portrayed it as a tribal conflict. It was just two bunches of African savages having a go at each other. That is how it was portrayed. Perhaps not put in those graphic terms, but certainly that was the implicit message of even newspapers like the New York Times, describing it as one of those African things which nobody should get involved in if they had any sense. The fact that this was a genocide, that it was a political act, it was the result of a political decision by educated, powerful men to try and wipe out a minority that was completely ignored, and that had disastrous consequences, because it meant the world was able to walk away. If you believe that it was just one of those inevitable things, then you could take the fatalistic attitude of saying, oh, they've done this all the time, they'll continue to do it, why should we get involved? Of course, it's not about that. It's not about that. It is about politics. It is about economics. And it's about history. And we have a responsibility in that.
It was actually very efficiently planned, wasn't it? Very efficiently planned and executed, as I understand it, and what involved a very large number of people. And I just wonder if you could briefly tell us a little bit about how that worked.
If you look at the facts and consider that in 100 days, 800,000 people were killed, and they were killed largely with machetes and clubs, with very primitive weapons, consider the speed that took, the organisation that it took. People were organised into work groups. It was there was a long tradition in Rwanda of people doing public works. You had to give a certain amount of your year to the government to do what was called clearing up work. And this was simply, this idea was perversely extended to include human beings, clearing up human beings, so that the work groups were ready to go. They were formed into militias and sent out onto the streets, the Interahamwe. The militia, those who stand together, they were sent out onto the streets, given areas to cleanse, and that they did with brutal efficiency. And every morning, the garbage trucks would drive around the capital, Kigali, and the other cities, manned by prisoners wearing these bizarre pink uniforms. They would go around common criminals and gather up the bodies of the dead and put them into garbage trucks to be buried in mass graves.
You've already talked about this a little bit. I mean, we don't, normally in pluralist liberal democracies, we don't experience these acts of large scale intercommunal bloodshed. I suppose Northern Ireland's the closest that we've come to that. Although, you know, in our society, racial, religious hatred, acts of ethnic violence, they're there all the time. And I just wonder if you could expand on what it is that prevents this happening under those circumstances. But what would it take to be able for it to happen here?
To be able to have a genocide in a country like Britain, you would need to do away with democracy, with parliamentary democracy, with the idea that the powerful can be questioned about their actions. You would also need to wipe out civil society, that remarkable network of organisations around this country, which represent the concerns of what are called ordinary people. I'm thinking of groups like Amnesty International. I think of NGOs, non-governmental organisations like Oxfam. I think of, in every city in this country, in every town, just the small groups which get together to make noise about local issues, to complain about what happens to their neighbourhoods. All of these things, you know, the idea that people have a voice, the idea that the powerful can be held to account. As long as you have that, and as long as that's institutionalised, you know, through parliamentary democracy, through a free press, through the organs of civil society, which are respected by the government, then I think you have a very efficient bulwark against genocide. If you lose that, if you go down the road of believing that we shouldn't give our politicians a hard time, that we shouldn't question, then you start the march towards Auschwitz, you start the march towards Rwanda.
What kind of responsibilities do the prosperous industrialised nations bear, do you think, in helping to shape the local nationalisms and ethnic rivalries that have led to so many of these mass slaughters in the last 50 years?
I think the greatest responsibility that we face is to engage with the developing world and with the kind of poorer countries where genocide tends to happen. The problem has been that the continent of Africa in particular was used for two things. It was a battleground for the Cold War, where America and the Soviet Union fought proxy wars, and it was used as a place which could be economically exploited with little benefit to the ordinary people and great benefit to the corrupt regimes that were propped up by both Moscow and Washington in the course of the Cold War. So it was seen as a place where people weren't human beings in the way that we were. They were just fit material to be played with and exploited. And that has had catastrophic consequences. We did not insist on democratization in places like Rwanda because it didn't suit us. We didn't insist on it in places like Mobutu's Congo because it was much easier to go in and plunder the country for what could be got out of it and to use people like Mobutu and the men who ran Rwanda as convenient allies in the game of Cold War politics. And that is a huge responsibility. And it is really the challenge about how we engage with the developing world, and Africa in particular, in the generations to come.
Some genocidal acts have been sort of hushed up or deliberately not recognised for what they are, where Western governments collude with despotic regimes for economic or strategic reasons. I mean, East Timor is one of the places that we're looking at, for example. Do you think this is simply the way of the world and will always be? Or is it realistic to think that national and international measures could be put in place that actually prevent this happening more effectively?
I think we collude all the time with human rights atrocities. We simply don't want to see them because it doesn't suit us. It does not suit the world to see what the Russians are doing in Chechnya, the kind of atrocities that are taking place because the Russians are now our allies. Now, that may be the business of politicians, to look at the world like that. It is not the business of journalists or human rights activists or indeed historians. Ours is to try and see the world as it is and as it affects the powerless and the weak. And of course, we don't need any new legislation to help us to do that. We have a genocide convention. We have an international body of law around the Geneva Convention and the protocols of that convention. We have the customary law of war. All of these things, you know, provide us with strong legal benchmarks. They provide us with legal obligations to act when people are being abused because of their ethnicity. And I think one of the more hopeful developments of the last 10 years has been, for the first time, a sign that the international community is willing to act. It's willing to put those, to put its money where its mouth is as far as legal obligation is concerned.
It's very difficult for Western governments to gauge the right response at the right time when these events unfold and they are subject to a lot of pressures, public opinion and so on. But do you think that steps could and should be taken much earlier on to actively deter acts of genocidal violence and ethnic cleansing?
I think the really important thing which we've got to develop is an international early warning system, so that when things like Rwanda happen or Bosnia erupts, we know very early on that this simply isn't another outbreak of tribal infighting or the kind of ritual brutality that people inflict on each other, that this is genocide. And remember, let's be very specific about what we're talking about. The attempt to annihilate in whole or in part an ethnic group, you know. We need to have mechanisms where the United Nations knows early exactly what is happening and moves swiftly to act. Now, how you create that is the big question. In a world situation where the budget of the United Nations is relentlessly under pressure, where the security interests of the major powers, the United States in particular, and Russia, are very, very narrow, particularly in the wake of what has happened on September the 11th. The focus on what is seen to be the security interest of the world is increasingly defined as what is the security interest of the major powers. And we've got to broaden that. We've got to remember that if you ignore what happens in places like Rwanda, if you ignore what happens in places like the former Yugoslavia, sooner or later those conflicts are going to erupt and they're going to arrive on your doorstep.
It's often very difficult for people to really appreciate why we should be so concerned about these kind of events, as they appear not to threaten us directly. And so you often get a case for not intervening, we can make it worse or whatever, and you know, we can't police the whole world, and all these kind of arguments which are put forward. How do you think people could... What could governments do to make people more aware of the interconnectedness of what is happening in Africa, Asia, and so on? I mean, we all know about the kind of global economy, globalism, and all those kind of things. But I think we have a rather limited understanding of what it really means. And I wonder if you have any suggestions on that front.
I'm a great believer in what I call passionate possibilism. In other words, you do what is possible where is possible, and you do it with heart, not reluctantly. And I think there is the beginnings of, in this country at least, a recognition by government that you simply can't turn your back, because we don't have a direct national interest. We don't have a direct economic interest in what is happening in a place like Rwanda. A very vivid memory of coming back in a taxi from the airport from Rwanda and being...
Thank you.